today. Rugby's dementia crisis. For The Guardian's senior sports writer Andy Bull, this story begins in 2003, in the last few minutes of the Rugby World Cup final when England took on Australia.
It was one of those moments when rugby, you know, is a popular sport, but it really grew out of its own bubble. And it made stars of those players for that period, particularly guys like Johnny Wilkinson, who obviously kicked the drop goal that won the game.
For Johnny Wilkinson, he drops for World Cup glory! Yeah! It's over! It's over!
I remember very much, you know, jumping up and down and hugging my dad when that ball went over the posts.
For Australia to come back, England have just won!
If you think about that moment starts with a line-out, which is a throw-in in rugby terms. And the guy who makes that throw-in was a player called Steve Thompson. He's the hooker. Everyone remembers that. They may not remember that line-out specifically, but they all remember that moment. But Steve doesn't really remember it himself.
And it was just the most bizarre experience because I'm watching these games and it's just like England were playing now. Like I'm watching and I'm watching a load of rugby players, but I'm on the pitch, but I just can't remember being there at all.
Why is it that Steve can't remember that game?
Because years later, it turns out that Steve has been diagnosed with early onset dementia and probable CTE, which is a degenerative brain disease.
And suddenly, you know, you start thinking to yourself, you know, you had a good memory, and then suddenly it starts getting a normal thing that you should have is not normal anymore.
Steve believes that the reason he can't remember that game is because of the sport itself. He is one of eight former players under the age of 45 who have been diagnosed with dementia and CTE, for which the only known cause is repeated blows to the head. They are now starting the process of bringing legal action against rugby's governing bodies, which could completely change the way the game is played. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, rugby's reckoning with dementia. Tell me about Steve Thompson. What is he like and what kind of rugby player was he?
Well, the first thing to say is that he was a really good rugby player.
Steve Thompson, this is a rare
chip
set.
Chip it!
Oh, what a beautiful dolly from Steve Thompson.
Steve Thompson with the interception. And England are going to be on the board.
I mean, you had to be good, obviously, to play for England, and you had to be good to win a World Cup.
You know, I was lucky with what I'd done, and it was the pinnacle of people's careers and that, to go there and win the World Cup.
He was really one of the final ingredients in the mix of that England team that made them into the champion side. He joined the team fairly recently before the World Cup and really kind of added an extra dimension to them. So he's a very dynamic player. And I sort of remember him charging around the pitch with the ball in hand on these kind of bullocking runs in which he would brush people out of the way.
Good lad. And there's another one coming. Touch judge can't keep up. There he goes, Walker.
Steve himself would say, you know, that he was never actually all that keen on rugby. And in fact, when he was a kid growing up, he couldn't really understand why anyone would want to play rugby. It never made much sense to him. So, I mean, Steve was much more interested in basketball. And actually, he was a speed skater as well.
No way.
Although he's quite embarrassed about that now.
Well, he shouldn't be. That's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's the photos of him in Lycra, maybe, for the speed skating. But yeah, he discovered rugby when he was 15. So he came to it quite late. You know, a lot of people, particularly a lot of people who go on to be internationals, would start much younger than that. I think it would be fair to say he was a slightly wayward kid, and the game gave him a way to really focus and channel his energy in a productive way. And it helped, of course, that he was naturally very good at it. For a hooker, the position he played, he was unusually big. I wouldn't call it revolutionary, but he was breaking the mold for what a hooker was typically like. And, you know, traditionally the hooker is there to take part in the scrums and to throw the ball in at the lineouts and not to do a whole lot more than that. But Steve was really a much more, like I say, dynamic and sort of all action, hard charging player all around the field.
What sort of career did he have and did he enjoy it?
Well, he had an enormously successful career as a player. He won a lot. But because he came to it late and because his passion was really basketball, I would say he always treated it as more of a job than a calling. In fact, he admits that one of the reasons he started playing was because he was in a bit of debt at the time and he thought one of the best ways to make money would be to try giving rugby a go in a serious way. So that's why he got into it. And I think, you know, he would say that while he enjoyed playing the game and he enjoyed the camaraderie of it, he didn't ever have the passion for the game that a lot of his teammates did.
But at this time, what was the job like? You know, what was the culture of rugby that he was working within?
Yeah, well, Steve came through an interesting time.
A revolution in the sport of rugby union. It's going professional.
Today's decision by the International Rugby Board brings about the most radical change in the sport for 100 years.
There will be no prohibition on payment or the provision of other material benefit to any person involved in the game.
He was one of the very first generation of players who played the game professionally, and that's why he thought he could make quite good money doing it. So the game of rugby union was amateur until 1995, when it became a full-time professional game. Almost overnight, really, that change happened. And Steve was an apprentice around that time and became a full-time player himself. It's hard to overstate what a radical change that was for the people playing it, because all of a sudden they were training full-time. So the demands on them increased hugely overnight. Steve will say himself he went from training 2 days a week to training 6 or 7 days a week. And when I say training, he would often be training, you know, twice a day sometimes.
It was just mindless when we were, you know, first going professional and things. You know, the contact sessions we were doing, the amount of contact we were doing, and to the head as well.
The interesting thing about that, I suppose, is that the game had become professional in that sense, but in many other senses, it was still amateur. It retained an amateur ethos. The medical support was still amateurish. The sports science behind it was still amateurish. The coaching was still amateurish. You had a group of players who all of a sudden were professional, and they found themselves with all this time to train. So the coaches essentially said, well, how are we going to use this time? We'll do the same thing we've always done and knock seven bells out of each other. And that's really what they did. And that's how Steve describes those early years in the sport.
There's a clip that I see from a specialist the other day on social media, and they've cut the top of the skull off. So you've got a brain, and then they hit the, and you can see the brain inside just going across. So when you actually start seeing that and you understand that, you can start seeing the amount of contacts and the amount of times that happen. And that's just in the game. So imagine when you're in a contact session in training, when you'll be doing that 20, 30, 40 times in 10, 15 minutes, because that's what they, you know, they say, oh, let's beast you. That's what we're going to do. We're going to make it hard. And you just sort of mindlessly doing it.
As someone, you know, who was watching the game as a fan, and then as a reporter, how did this shift in rugby union change the game on the pitch?
Well, you know, the most obvious change is that the players became much, much bigger. And everyone who follows rugby knows that and will talk about that. These days, the players, you know, they're all gym bunnies. They all have enormous muscles. And really, the game has become incredibly physical, incredibly intense, incredibly ferocious. Biggest change we've seen in the sport is a huge increase in the number of tackles, which will now, you know, number up to sort of 200, sometimes even 300 a game. There was a time when I think the number of tackles would be something more like 80 to 100. So you've seen a sort of doubling or even tripling of the amount of tackling contact that's happening. At the same time, you've seen a huge increase in the ferocity of the contest at what's called the breakdown, which is when a player is tackled and the two teams are competing to win possession of the ball. You know, there's a lot of banging, a lot of collisions going on there as well.
Was this the sort of thing then that Steve was doing on a daily basis? You know, what does he remember about the kind of physical impacts he received when he was training and playing?
Well, yeah, Steve was, you know, literally putting his head on the line on a daily basis. He was putting his head on the line when he was practicing his scrums using these scrummaging machines that were fastened to the ground. Huge amount of force. If you think of eight very big men all pushing together as one, and Steve, as the hooker, is really at the sharp end of that. He's the guy who's the tip of a pyramid of eight people, and they're all pushing against another pyramid of eight people, or in this case, padded machine. But he would also, you know, be making these tackles, and he would be using his head to make clear outs, which is when a player is trying to force an opposition player away from the ball, clear him off the ball so that his own team can win back possession of it. And he'll do that in Steve's era. He would try and do that by diving into that player head first and using his head to push him backwards off the ball. You know, we were talking about the amateur ethos of the sport, and part of that as well was that you would kind of shrug off injuries, and you would shrug off, in particular, head injuries. There was this idea that, you know, it was just a knock to the head. So Steve will talk about, he in particular had a reputation for someone who would often black out after these training sessions. He would stand up and his eyes would swim with stars and the blood would rush from his head and he would sometimes faint. And people would say, oh, that's Steve. He's just having a little sleep. He'll come round in a minute. And that's really not a condemnation of the people saying that, but it speaks to the culture of the game at the time. But, you know, what these guys would say is they were expecting this career to have a physical toll, but no one warned them that it would have this mental toll as well. That they expected their bodies to be in bits. They were prepared for that, but they weren't expecting their brains to be in bits as well.
When did Steve notice that the game had begun to take a toll on him mentally?
Yeah, Steve really noticed the mental symptoms after he had retired. But it was only after he retired in the mid-2010s that he started to develop these symptoms of his dementia. And those symptoms for Steve include memory loss.
You know, that's starting already, where, you know, I am forgetting a lot of things. I am not the person I was before. You know, at work, you know, I'll go into a room to remember to go and pick something up and then I forgot what it is.
Mood swings, anxiety. He talks about having panic attacks. He talks about his personality changing. He was a very sociable person and he now feels he's a very antisocial person. At its worst, there have been moments when he finds he even struggles to remember his wife's name and she'll have to look at him and remind him.
With my kids and my wife now, that what am I going to put them through? In the, you know, I've got the early stages of a brain injury and dementia, and you know, you forget what's going on, and suddenly, you know, it's a lot of pressure I've put on other people now.
Gosh, that's so sad. How long did it take him to connect his memory loss to his rugby playing career?
It took quite a long time, actually. And it was only really when he started talking to a teammate of his, a guy called Alex Popham.
I started rugby when I was four and I played professionally for 14 seasons.
And Alex is another player who's been diagnosed with early onset dementia.
I had my diagnosis at the start of lockdown. We call it D-Day, Diagnosis Day. And it was a massive, massive shock to have the diagnosis of probable CTE and early onset dementia at the time I was 40.
And the two of them met up for a coffee and Alex was talking about the problems he was having in his own life with memory loss and mood swings, similar symptoms to Steve's, but a little more severe in all honesty. And Steve, you know, was sort of sitting there thinking, well, hold on, I recognize that. I recognize what you're telling me. That makes sense to me too. Slightly, the scales are dropping from his eyes at that point, and he's thinking, well, hold on. If this is what's happening to Alex, maybe this is what's happening to me.
Was this something that he and Alex and others like them had realised was happening to them while they were playing, or was this the first kind of time?
Well, you get different answers about that. These players are entering into a group litigation action, so it's very easy to treat them as a sort of a monolithic cohort. But they're obviously all individuals, and dementia is a very individual syndrome. So in Steve's case, he would say that it didn't really occur to him at all during his playing days. How he describes it was that it was like having his car MOT'd. He drives the car every day, but he relies on someone else to do the MOT on it. And that's how he felt about his body and his brain when he was playing. He was playing every day, but he was relying on other people, coaches, doctors, medical support staff, to be worrying about that for him. Whereas one of the other players we've spoken to, Michael Lippmann, who also played for England a little later than Steve, he would say that he was quite aware of it towards the end of his career. And he did realize that maybe he was developing a problem, but he decided to play on anyway.
Steve had begun to notice this memory loss, and then he spoke to Alex. When did he get a medical opinion on what was happening for him?
Steve really only got the diagnosis very recently, just a couple of weeks before this became public. Early onset dementia and probable CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is this neurodegenerative brain disease. The science of CTE is complicated and disputed. There's a spectrum of opinions about it. But what we do know and what we can say is that the only known cause for CTE is repeated blows to the head. One of the reasons the science of CTE is so complicated is that it can only be fully diagnosed post-mortem. And that's why Steve's diagnosis is described as probable CTE.
First, you know, my family, my wife, my kids, thinking, what am I putting them through now already? And then also when it gets worse, you know, what are we going to, you know, already we're looking, you know, when we buy our house and things like that, looking at bungalows or where I can live downstairs and things like that. Because even now we were looking at, because I struggle getting up and downstairs some days. Some days I'm really good, some days I'm really bad.
Steve is one of eight former players launching legal proceedings against World Rugby, the Rugby Football Union and Welsh Rugby Union over what they claim is a failure to protect them from the risks caused by concussions. Could there be more players that have been affected by this?
The lawyer who's organising the legal action says that he has spoken to almost 100 players who are showing various symptoms. Those symptoms, I should stress, are not all as severe as Steve's and Michael's and Alex's, but the lawyer does say nonetheless that they are showing symptoms of some kind. I would add too, those 100 are from across rugby league and rugby union. They're obviously two different codes of rugby.
And just, you know, for context, how common is dementia in people in their early 40s?
Well, yeah, in the UK, amongst the population that's aged between 30 and 44, experts say you would expect around one in every 9,500 people to have dementia. That's about 0.01% of that cohort. So 11 diagnoses amongst Steve's generation of rugby players, you're looking at about 1% of the number of professional rugby players over that period of time. So you're talking there, and these are very rough numbers, but they give you an idea. You're talking there about it being about 100 times more likely than your average member of the public.
And that's a very striking number, but are there proven links between rugby and dementia?
No. As I say, a lot of the science here is uncertain, and that has to be stressed and repeated. There are a spectrum of opinions about this. As I say, the science of CTE is unclear. And what we do know about it is that it's been diagnosed in American footballers.
It's an issue that's already cast a shadow over the NFL, brain damage suffered by some players as a result of repeated hard hits.
It's been diagnosed in victims of domestic abuse. It's been diagnosed in circus performers who have had a lot of falls. The only thing all these different groups have in common is that they were all exposed to repeated head trauma.
What is the science behind that head trauma? You know, how much do we know about the impact that playing rugby can have on your brain?
I am very reluctant to present myself as an expert on that. It's really at the cutting edge of medical science. What is becoming clear, and what I think is a really radical change to how we've thought about this issue, is that for the last 10 or 15 years, across sport and in rugby in particular, we've thought about it as a concussion problem. So that would be typically, you know, the instances when you're being knocked out cold. But actually, what's become increasingly clear and what's now fairly widely accepted among the scientific community is that it's about sub-concussions as well. It's literally just about the number of times you are hit in the head. Almost, they describe it as like a dose. And once you've had that dose of blows to the head, you're at risk of suffering from CTE.
Do you think that this was something that rugby union could have prevented, could have protected against? You know, was the sport aware of the consequences of repeated blows to the head?
That is the question. And that's the question this case will turn on, really. There are others, obviously, but that's the big one. Who knew what when, and whether the authorities could reasonably have been expected to do more to protect the players. One personal opinion that's occurred to me as I've been thinking about this in the last few days is that it is widely accepted that the game is much safer to play now, although it's more powerful even than it was in Steve's day and much more physically demanding. We don't have that amateur ethos anymore. The game has become more professional. There is much better medical support, much better sports science, and coaching attitudes are much more enlightened. The idea of it's just a knock on the head, shrug it off, or give him some smelling salts and he'll get over it. That's completely gone from the game. But the necessary implication of that is if the game is safer now, then surely it could have been safer then. I suppose the defense would be, well, we didn't know then what we know now. Well, I'm afraid if you look hard enough, you will find there were people around who had an idea of this problem. The question is why we didn't listen to them more, why society took so long to come around to the connection between blows to the head and dementia. And that's a difficult question, and it's not one I have an answer to.
Coming up, how players speaking out could completely change the game of rugby union. Andy, what does Steve and the other players want to get from this lawsuit? What does he hope to change in the game?
Well, alongside the lawsuit, they've put out a list of what they call 15 commandments, which are demands almost of the authorities for ways in which they could change the game.
This is about us being able to explain what we think the game needs to make it a better place and a safer place for people to play it, because people are always going to play it. But it's just everyone at the top just looking down, saying, like, you know, the main asset of this lovely game are the players, and we've got to make sure we treat them like that. We don't treat them like bits of meat. They just have to train and do what we tell them to do, and then when they're no good, we get rid of them, and that's what happens.
You know, some of the key ones would include limiting the amount of contact training that's happening. The authorities will say that's already happening, and perhaps it is. Clubs these days, as I say, do not train in the way they did when Steve was a player. They're much smarter about it. But still, it seems to me like it would be an easy thing to do for the authorities to say, we're going to limit you to 16 hours of contact training a season, or however much they settled on. It's worth explaining that the NFL in American football did exactly this in 2011, and their teams now have a limit to how much contact training they can do.
But if someone pulls a hamstring or a muscle or anything like that, you know, they look after it straight away. There's a problem straight away. So, you know, your brain, and that's exactly the same. You know, it's got to be looked after.
I mean, how would this change the game, though, Andy? I mean, is it possible to play it with less contact?
That's the big question that underpins this, really. If we get to the point where the science does become conclusive, that what we're talking about is dementia being caused by a series of small blows over time, it is hard to see how rugby can continue in its present form. It's worth stressing that professionally you will see players retire younger and have shorter careers. One idea that has been discussed is whether professional players ought to have permits to play the game, and for those permits only to be given to them if they have scans. So that's how the game might change professionally, but there is also a much bigger question about whether it can ever sort of reverse the direction it's taken and turn itself back into something more like the game that it used to be when players were smaller and it was less about contact and collision and more about space. To be honest, I can't see that happening. I can't see how that gets rolled back, really.
Andy, has this changed how you watch rugby and how you think of what is good rugby?
Yeah, it has changed how I've watched rugby, and I've watched rugby all my life. I grew up in Bath, which is a big rugby town. And maybe my opinions towards the game were changing anyway because it has become so brutal. But it's very hard for me to celebrate that brutality, to write about that physicality and ferocity in the way I have done for the last 10, 15 years since I've made my living writing about the sport, when you know what the cost of it is. It's very hard for me to lionize players in the way I have done for putting their bodies on the line and for making those huge, big hits when I know what the consequences could be. I want to say again, those consequences, it's not necessary that they follow. There is not an absolute link, but clearly the risk is there.
I just want my kids to, you know, when they're my age, to be able to walk around, run around and have a good mind and not be sort of battered around the head a bit and sort of, you know, sometimes not being able to walk properly and that. And if I can guard them from that, that's what I'll do.
And what about Steve? He's just 42, a father of four, and he has a dementia diagnosis. What does the future look like for him and his family?
I would hesitate to speculate about what anyone's future is going to look like at this point. It's not clear how degenerative the condition is going to be for Steve or any of these individuals. What is clear to me, and plenty of your listeners will already know this, dementia is an awful, awful disease. And the toll on the individuals, and in particular their families, is indescribably cruel. Right now, for these players, part of that awfulness manifests itself in the form of uncertainty, of not knowing what the future is going to look like, not knowing whether this is going to get worse, how it might get worse.
You know, there's some days when it's not just my head, my whole body's just in bits from it. And sometimes my kids help me down the stairs. You know, I have good days where I can sort of run around the field a little bit and play football. And then there's other days where I'm just in absolute agony and my headache and suddenly think you can't see properly. And you just think to yourself, you know, was it worth it? And I don't think it was.
Andy, thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me on.
That was Andy Bull. Go to theguardian.com to read all the latest reaction to this story and also watch some of the interviews he's done with former players like Steve Thompson. In response to Andy's reporting, a spokesperson for World Rugby said, the organisation takes player safety very seriously and implements injury prevention, management and education strategies based on the latest available knowledge, research and evidence. The Welsh Rugby Union said it supported that statement. After the story was published last week, the Rugby Football Union's top official said the sport is safe to play and that the future of the RFU is not at risk from any claims that might be made. Now, everyone's lives have been disrupted by coronavirus this year, but it is children and young people, especially those from poorer families, who have been hit the hardest. Whether it was school closures, the exams fiasco, lack of jobs, cramped living conditions in a lockdown that banned socialising or playing sport, many have struggled with their mental health. This year, The Guardian and Observer's Christmas Appeal is asking our readers and listeners to help raise money for charities devoted to children and young people, UK Youth, Young Minds and the Child Poverty Action Group. You can donate today at theguardian.com/charityappeal 2020. Or you can call our charity telethon to donate on Saturday, the 19th of December, where you'll find Guardian and Observer journalists on the other end of the line, including John Crace, Polly Toynbee, Jonathan Friedland, Amelia Gentleman, as well as our editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner. Or you might end up talking to me or Anushka. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alice Fordham and sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.